Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, it's lunchtime, and quite frankly, I don't have much of an appetite because the president just spoke from the Rose Garden in perhaps the most sanctimonious tone I've ever heard him in. He was almost whiner-in-chief when making the case for serious, I believe was his word, tax increases on the wealthiest Americans. The deception, the complete demagoguery, it was just in full form today, and it's just unfair that anybody has to start the week listening to him, period, much less going through some of the ridiculous points he was trying to make. Real quickly, here's three of the lowlights. We're going to start with our bad martini today. We've got the president talking about how the government must act like a family because, of course, families can raise taxes on people. And we also have the president lying about how much savings there are in comparison to tax revenue. And then my personal favorite on the choices we have to make.
The government has to do what families across this country have been doing for years. We have to cut what we can't afford to pay for what really matters. All told, this plan cuts $2 in spending for every dollar in new revenues. Either we ask the wealthiest Americans to pay their fair share in taxes, or we're going to have to ask seniors to pay more for Medicare. We can't afford to do both.
Jim, it's one or the other. Either people starve or, the rich people have to pay taxes here. You know, I love the fact that he says rich people are being asked to do nothing. We'll get to that in a minute, where Paul Ryan's in our good martini, and he explains how much exactly they're already contributing and would contribute. But this is obviously complete demagoguery. He's throwing false straw men out there about choices we have to make, as if charging seniors through the nose for Medicare is the only other option we have than soaking the rich. His idea of the families making the same decisions as government is ridiculous because families don't go $1.6 trillion in debt, usually.
That's deficit. The debt itself is $14 trillion, remember.
Exactly, and soon to be $16 because that's been granted. And every sober analysis out there says we're actually going to be getting taxed $3 for every dollar in spending cuts here. So not exactly believable, and he just really had a whiny tone about him this morning that made it truly pathetic, I thought.
But other than that, a good speech, right, Greg?
Yes, exactly.
Actually, I mean, it was kind of – if you didn't see it, listeners – good for you. You really didn't miss anything. I think what's kind of striking, it sounded like every other speech we've ever heard from Obama. That was, very, tired positioning, tired phrases, tired arguments, basically a rehash of the job speech. Basically the insinuation that, the primary cause of our $14 trillion debt is that the millionaires and billionaires aren't paying their fair share. Which, again, I had something in the Inquirer this weekend where I kind of looked at it and figured out that if you taxed all the rich people at 70%, which is way more than Obama's proposing, Robert Reich is the only person who's had the either the insanity or the guts or however you want to classify it to even propose that, you would take care of, Greg, one quarter of this year's deficit.
Exactly. So
this is also assuming that they didn't change any of their behavior. So the idea that, we're just one good tax hike on the rich away from balancing the books is fairly ridiculous. I was kind of struck that Obama at one point said, we cannot cut our way out of this hole. You know what, Greg? I want to try. Even if it doesn't work, we'll make the hole not so bad. So let's give this a try. We've never really tried this approach. Nobody's ever said, let's cut first. Let's cut every last bit we can. Let's get rid of every last bit of Soylindra and every other, group of spending that is basically designed to help out donors, et cetera. Let's really say to American people, we have really cut as far as we can, and then let's ask them for more. It never goes that way. It always says, well, maybe we'll cut a little bit in the future, but we've got to raise your taxes right now. And, one of the first responses, John Huntsman issued a response during the speech to kind of give you a sense of just how predictable it was. But Pat Toomey, who's not only a member of the Senate, but also on the Super Duper Committee, he said that, look, this is proposals that couldn't pass a Democrat Congress in 2009. There's no way this is passing a Republican-controlled House and a much more balanced Senate in 2011. So Obama knows this isn't going on. This was a campaign speech. It was not a serious legislation proposal. And that's why they had the band playing in the Rose Garden at the end of the event. So.
Pretty sure we spent our way into the hole, so I'm pretty sure we can cut spending to get out of the hole, or at least a big chunk of it. And not making the stimulus-level spending permanent would be a good place to start. Just a horrible way to start the week. And I just want to clarify one thing. Jim's column was in the Philadelphia Inquirer, not the National Inquirer.
Actually, I had something on space alien babies. That was the other article I had.
Well, you mentioned that John Huntsman had a mid-speech rebuttal. Even topping that was Paul Ryan on Sunday. As you mentioned, the president's speech was entirely predictable, tired phrasing. Paul Ryan, of course, knew exactly what was going to be said. He had gotten a decent preview of what the plan was Sunday from the New York Times and so forth. And so this on Fox News Sunday is Paul Ryan once again exquisitely summarizing why the Obama economic strategy is abysmal.
The world taxes their businesses at about 25%, and he's saying we're going to tax these job creators at above 45% with this new tax. It what it does is it adds further instability to our system, more uncertainty, and it punishes job creation and those people who create jobs. Class warfare, Chris, may make for really good politics, but it makes for rotten economics.
Man, I like listening to Paul Ryan talk about this stuff. And another issue that's come out there, you know, this whole Warren Buffett pays less of a tax rate than his secretary. That is so deceiving, given that Obama's referring to the capital gains or dividend tax rate on top of what Buffett should be paying in his income tax. So, well, he's referring to the double taxation, not the main taxation rate, which is just pathetic.
What Obama does, and it's been going on since, you know, since Buffett has been promoting this, is that, look, you can have income from a salary from work you do, or you can have income from investments. You know, Warren Buffett is a very big investor. Thus, a very big chunk of his income comes from investments. His secretary does not have as much money to invest. Now, you could say, all right, let's lower the income tax to the point where it's comparable to investment. But instead, Obama's approach is, no, we got to figure out a way to punish investment because investment is bad. Investment is something that is, you know, somehow they've been getting a sweet deal that we need to end that. Now, in most countries, in many places, you say, wait a minute, investment is a good thing. Investment is how you create jobs. Businesses cannot hire people without capital, and they get capital from people investing in them. But, you know, if you curse at the little Monopoly man every time you break out the game and you insist that you should be getting hotels because they're fancy and you deserve them, and you know, the entire Obama view of the world is that somehow if we just get rich people to pay more, things will be better, when in fact, no, that's not the case. I have a new theory, which I actually am going to probably write about this later today, kind of a sneak preview for listeners of the Three Martini Lunch. One of the most powerful endorsements Obama had in the 08 cycle was Warren Buffett. I'd put him and Colin Powell to be one and two. How much do you think endorsing the Buffett rule and calling it the Buffett rule is designed to make sure that Warren Buffett does not endorse anyone else?
It could be.
I mean, he kind of has to, right? I mean, there's no way that Buffett could come out and say, you know, the economic performance under Obama has been really disappointing, and I think it's time for, you know, some new blood in there.
Yeah, I think most people are tired of the Warren Buffett analogy because people who together make a quarter million dollars and oftentimes live in high cost of living areas don't see themselves on the same par with a guy who's worth a few dozen billion dollars.
Oh, absolutely. I you know, there's a couple that makes $250,000 count being the highest tax bracket. I think there are a lot of people, you know, they call them Henrys, high earners, not rich yet. And this is one of those things where this is, you know, in Obama's mind, you know, because think about it, he doesn't pay his own taxes. He hires somebody to take care of them. He's making a salary of $400,000 a year. He's living rent-free. All of his transportation costs are taken care of. He never pumps his own gas. I mean, Barack Obama lives a life of unimaginable luxury, even by the standards of Warren Buffett. And yet, you know, his idea, and yet this is the person who gets to determine what working families are really going through and what rich people are really like. I kind of almost wonder if there's a certain guilt factor for Obama, that because he's living his life in the lap of luxury, he wants to punish all those other people who are doing so, who haven't done it by the noble endeavor of, you know, pledging to lower the oceans and heal the sick and such.
Yeah, and Ryan also did a good job in that interview with Chris Wallace on Sunday about talking about how the president does, in fact, have proposed Medicare cuts in there. It's not for recipients. It's for the service providers, which means even more seniors will be denied care because it's absolutely right now not worth their time and money for doctors to provide that care, and it's going to be even less so down the road. So the president using Medicare as the demagoguery issue is really disgusting right there. Anyway, as we heard ad nauseum during the president's job speech, Jim, when do we have to pass the jobs bill?
The fierce urgency of now.
Exactly. So
if we pass this bill, we'll create jobs tomorrow, even though I haven't introduced the bill. Yes.
That's right. So when is this actually going to be considered by the democratically controlled Senate? Seems like a fair question that CNN's Candy Crowley asked the number two Democrat, Dick Durbin, on Sunday.
When's this jobs bill getting on the Senate floor?
It'll start the debate this week. Now, there are going to be a lot of variations and ideas.
The bill won't be on the floor to vote on this week. I mean, you guys can debate anything at any point. When's the bill going to get on the floor?
The bill's on the calendar. Majority Leader Reid moved it to the calendar. It is ready and poised. I hope the Republicans will come to it after the recess?
So next month, or when will it actually begin to act on?
I think that's more realistic. That would be next month.
Well, next month. So the fierce urgency of now has been pushed back another month. I'm glad, though, Jim, that the bill is poised, which makes it a good candidate for the next Miss America competition.
Well, when Obama slammed Congress for dragging its feet today, I wonder if he meant Senator Durbin, his old senior senator partner. But we'll see. I mean, we all know this is designed to blame Republicans, blah, 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 blah. But I think it's fairly revealing that, you know, I'm also kind of picturing a slanted calendar, because the bill gets put on the calendar and then it goes on the floor, and I'm picturing papers tumbling down or something like that is how the bill moves. I'm picturing also that rolled up little critter from the How the Bill Becomes a Law Schoolhouse Rock edition. But anyway, it's kind of ironic that Obama comes out and slams Congress right after his buddy is stuck admitting, yeah, we'll get to it next month. The fierce urgency of whenever.
That's exactly right. But, you know, this does set the stage. You know, I was thinking, you know, we've talked about for a long time how this is basically a fight between, the principles we were talking about in the midterm elections, the cuts and the reforms that are going to be difficult but needed. Is America ready for that? And that's going to be the key issue in 2012. All it really has to be is a repudiation of Obama's huge government disingenuous approach to economics. And hopefully, people are ready to make that choice in the right direction.
Amen, Greg. But I observe it's Monday.
Exactly right.
We got four more days of this. This is a particularly cringe-inducing edition of the Three Martini Lunch. This is the going straight to martinis 4, 5, and 6.
In case you can tell, I'm a little bit fired up in the wake of that speech. Anyway, Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.